prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we review underseen horror movies, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm Erica.
And I'm Lance.
And we have a special guest for this episode, Ian Jane, who runs the site rockshockpop.com and who also provided the commentary track for the film that we're discussing in this episode. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about Rock Shock Pop?
Yeah, I can. So the quick version of it, the site was formed in late 2010. So we're past a decade now. I used to write for AV Maniacs, which was DVD Maniacs before that, which was pretty much exclusively focused on cult films from all genres, all countries, whatever was interesting. You know, we would write about it. That site started to fall apart towards the end. And so I left, started my own site with kind of a similar intention, but also wanting to cover comic books, music, television shows, like kind of anything pop culture. The focus is still 85% cult films, but, you know, hey, if I saw a cool concert, well, pre-COVID, if I saw a cool concert, I want to write about that, post pictures of that, I can do that. Like the format's just a little more open. It's updated daily. It has been updated daily for at least 8 of the 10.5 years we've been around, which is a lot of work, but something I take some pride in. And we've got a message board. You know, it's not the biggest, most active message board on the planet, but it's friendly and more or less free of jerks for the most part, which is rare on message boards.
Yeah, I was going to say that's important to have these days.
Occasionally we do interviews with people, either in the music business or the home video business. You know, we've interviewed David from Severin Films and Steven from Unearthed Films, Lewis from Massacre Video, guys who are kind of in the know and into the stuff that people like we are interested in.
Awesome. So I mentioned that Ian's a guest because he provided the commentary track for the film we're discussing, and that is Black Magic 2 from 1976. As of this recording, you can rent it on iTunes, but we would actually suggest that you pick up the 88 Films Blu-ray release. However, keep in mind it is Region B, so you're going to need a region-free player for it. And as of this recording, it has 624 views on Letterboxd.
And I want to jump in and point out that it is Shoggist. I don't know if you said that already.
I didn't say that. Sorry. I already forgot it's Shoggist.
It's Shoggist on Unsung Horrors here. So all month we are celebrating.
You should trademark that.
Yeah, Erica came up with it.
I don't think I did. I don't feel like I'm not smart. Like, I feel like somebody else came. I've seen Shaw Timber, which I don't feel flows as well.
No. Shoggist is better.
I think so.
It's no question.
Somebody else did it, I'm sure. I'm sure I didn't come up with it. I'm going to search high and low. And if not, I'm throwing a motherfucking trademark on that. So, Ian, how did you come to get the opportunity to do the commentary for Black Magic 2?
So 88 Films came to me, the guy who had been doing most of their Shaw Brothers commentaries. They severed ties with him temporarily. They needed somebody, I would imagine, to turn it around fairly quickly. So they approached me by email. Honestly, I was a little hesitant about it at first. I don't speak or read Chinese, and I know I'm going to mangle names on that commentary, and I'm probably going to mangle names during this podcast. Which is something I don't want to do.
Right.
But not reading or speaking Chinese, it just kind of comes with the territory. But I thought about it for a while. I watched the movie again because I hadn't seen it, you know, in probably 10 years or so, around the time they approached me. And I thought, yeah, all right, I've got enough to say about this that I think I can pull something off. Which led to doing a lot of research, again, which can be tricky when you don't read or speak Chinese. Mm-hmm. But I was able to kind of dig into a little bit of like the actual use of black magic in Chinese culture. I was able to find some interesting articles on, you know, English language Chinese websites, or Chinese news websites, I mean. Find some information about the director, the locations, and just kind of give a bit of an analysis as I went through it all. you know, no one's beaten down my door to have me do it again. But but I was personally pleased with the way I thought it turned out fine. I don't feel like I embarrassed myself too much. It wasn't my first commentary. I had done a couple prior to that for Media Blasters. They had a couple of box sets called Rare Flicks, which were just like cheapest of the cheap kind of B movies that they put out. And I was friendly with Richard York, who worked there at the time. And he and another guy named Dave, who worked for Media Blasters, and myself got together in Richard's apartment with a bunch of malt liquor and a case of beer and just recorded commentaries for a couple of their releases. But they weren't advertised on the packaging. They were hidden. So unless you own the discs and flip the audio on and off, you don't know they're there. But they are there. And at least I think they count.
I think and that then counts.
And then since then, I've done a commentary with my friend Horace Cordier, who also writes for Rock Shock Pop occasionally, on the Jungle Holocaust DVD that Code Red put out about a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
That I believe Kino is reissuing with the commentary soon. If it's not out already, I'd have to look into that. But
nice. Awesome.
I'm going to check my rare flicks on my shelf after this. okay, so Black Magic, really quick synopsis of it. Basically, a black magician is casting spells and he's drinking breast milk in order to stay young in an unnamed tropical city. So we have two couples, one of them, both of them are doctors. And then in the other couple, the husband is a doctor and he has called the other couple to come help him investigate the source of mysterious afflictions at his hospital. So it takes a lot of convincing and many more black magic spells to be cast before the new doctor who's arrived is finally convinced that black magic actually exists. And so then with a talisman and the eyeballs of a white magician, and by white, I mean good. And I don't, God, that came out wrong too. I'm just going to cut that. He goes to confront the black magician and put an end to the evil spells. I left out the very opening part of it because we'll get to that when we actually talk about the movie, like the opening.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So since this is our first Shawgust episode, we should probably talk briefly about Shaw Brothers Studios. Yeah. We're not going to do a full deep dive. There's plenty of other places you can go to find out full histories and all of that. This is just a very basic overview for folks who may not be familiar with Shaw Brothers Studios. So, Ian, what can you tell us about Shaw Brothers and producer Run Run Shaw?
The quick version, because it's something that we could go on and on for hours, if not days, about. So the three brothers started a company in the 20s. English name would be Unique, I believe, if I'm remembering that correctly. And they were on the mainland in Shanghai doing distribution. They did well. From there, they started their own film production company and based it pretty much in Hong Kong. And they started the Shaw Brothers in 58, if I remember correctly. And then from the 60s, they just kind of took over. They signed a lot of the big players to contracts, a lot of the big names in the acting business at the time into contracts. And they took over the martial arts genre, which is what they're best known for. But, I mean, it wasn't limited to martial arts at all. There's musicals, there's, you know, soap operas and dramas, there's romance, there's comedy, there's action, exploitation, and then there's the horror stuff, which I'm sure will be the focus of our talk as we go through this.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not really active the way they were, obviously. I mean, the legacy is there. Their catalog is massive. There's hundreds of films. They were cranking out, you know, 30 to 40 a year at one point, I believe, during their heyday. If anybody made a dent in North America in terms of like bringing Asian films to like a Western audience, it was the Shaw Brothers at that time, because a lot of that stuff got shown on TV too. Mm-hmm. There were English dubs done for a lot of them. I know that like my first experience with Shaw Brothers stuff was watching Kung Fu movies as a kid with my dad. We'd come home from church Sunday morning and, you know, we'd tune into Action Theater or WUTV out of Buffalo, and there would be dubbed Kung Fu movies on there. And I don't remember everything that I saw because I was, you know, we're talking 40 years ago at this point, 35, 40 years ago, dating myself. But I specifically remember seeing 36 Chambers Shaolin as a kid and that making a big impression on me and not really knowing what it was, but knowing that it was different and that it was interesting. And then when I got a little older and I was in Toronto for college, there was a video store called Suspect Video that was within walking distance of my place. And they had tons of foreign films, and not just Asian stuff, like everything. Like that's how I discovered Bergman, and it's how I discovered a lot of the Italian horror greats. It's also how I discovered Russ Meyer. Was just like renting things randomly from what these guys had to offer. And they had a big Shaw Brothers section and a big Kung Fu section, but they also had the horror stuff there as well. I guess the DVD boom years of the early to mid 2000s introduced probably a lot of us to their output, because I don't want to mention Harvey Weinstein, but I have to mention Harvey Weinstein. Yeah. I mean, he distributed a lot of their stuff on home video, and then other companies like Media Blasters got involved. And for a while there, it seemed like there was a Shaw Brothers movie coming out every 2 weeks or so on DVD, and, you know, a nice remastered widescreen transfer with English subtitles and sometimes with extra features and commentaries that were interesting. And I've gone off on a tangent here.
No, not at all. We do that.
That's how I personally got into it. And again, I'm not a Shaw Brothers historian. I don't want to pretend that I am, but the influence is certainly there. And I mean, it's not just cinematic either. You think about the Wu-Tang Clan for a second, you know, yeah. Think about like the influence that they had on the hip hop scene, and think about guys like Quentin Tarantino, obviously, who've lifted from a lot of Shaw Brothers films. You could say it's an homage, whatever you want to say, but I mean, can't deny the influence there.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. I mean, it's hard for, you know, it's a machine, you know, like,
yes, absolutely.
They have their own 46 acre lot on Clearwater mm-hmm. Bay. And they even had actors and like crew people living at the studio, like while they were under contract. And it was
If they're pumping out 30 to 40 films.
Yeah.
A year, it's like,
it's mm-hmm. insane. Like the output. So and I feel like my experience is kind of similar to yours, Ian. Like I remember watching stuff on, you know, on TV as a kid, but it never really registered. If you asked me which ones I saw, I would never be able to tell you. And I probably just watched it and thought they were entertaining and fun because I probably thought like the voices were funny and like that. But I remember being thoroughly entertained by them. And only later in my years am I watching them and actually being able to distinguish who's who, because you keep seeing them over and over in different roles and, you know, different movies, and like actually starting to be able to rank movies by like which ones I like. Whereas before I was like, I don't know, I just like watching Kung Fu. Like I just have random movies on my shelf and I just pop them in for fun kind of thing.
Yeah. So. And with my experience, a lot of it was just like, hey, this is Kung Fu, but it's not Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. And as a kid, again, you know, I grew up in Ontario, Canada, just on the other side of the border. And I had no way. I had nobody to really guide me on any of this stuff. It was the television was my guide, and it was like whatever I got on TV was what I could digest. And, you know, as I got older, I could buy stuff through the mail. You know, that would broaden my horizons. And like I said, once I got to Toronto and I had the rentals, that was huge. But when you watch that stuff on TV, like, you don't know the names of these people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And as a kid, you're not watching the credits, probably. At least I wasn't. I mean, I do now, and I have for decades, but like, when I was like 6-7 years old watching this stuff with my dad, it's not like my dad was like, hey, pay attention to the credits. You need to know who made this stuff. My dad didn't care.
Right.
and neither did I at that age. So, yeah, I mean, I guess as you grow into adulthood and you just develop an appreciation of it and you understand the importance of the different roles that different people, you know, on the cast and crew play. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of go from there and you research who did what. You know, you find directors that you like and actors that you like, just like you would with from any part of the country.
Yeah, for sure. That's a huge part of it, is just like, who made this? Because I want to see more of what they did.
Yeah, exactly. I could use an example for a second. Like when I was, let's see, I'd come home from work at Arby's. So I would have been 19. And there was a channel out of Toronto called City TV that I got. And they would show stuff late at night uncut. And I was channel surfing. And I came across this lesbian vampire movie. And I stopped because, hey, nudity on TV. This is weird. This is I'm intrigued. This is like nothing I've ever seen before. And I didn't know what the hell the film was called. And it wasn't until like 6 or 7 years later that I rented a copy of Vampiros Lesbos by Jess Franco and figured out this was the movie I saw on TV. But I didn't stick around and watch the credits.
I was waiting. I was like, I wonder what movie it is, because Lesbian Vampires doesn't narrow it down at all.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
All right, so getting into the crew for Black Magic 2. And like I said in the last episode, we're jumping into Black Magic 2. You don't need to have seen Black Magic 1 in order to watch this movie. It's not a, it's a sequel in name only. And we're also, we're not doing Black Magic 1 because it had over 1,000 views on Letterboxd. But we might still, Lance, I saw your Letterboxd reviews. I already know what's coming, but I mean, or your scores. So we might do a quick like comparison, like which one do you prefer if you want?
Honestly, it's not a bad use of your time. it's a good one. I do prefer the second film. I think it's a little more over the top, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you guys at some point decide you're going to discuss it, I'll listen.
All right. All right. So Black Magic 2 and Black Magic 1, both directed by Ho Meng Hua, and the screenwriter was Quan Ni. Ho Meng Hua has 40 plus directing credits, and he collaborated with Quan Ni on multiple films, including Oily Maniac, The Mighty Pecking Man, and The Flying Guillotine, as well as, like I mentioned, Black Magic 1. Quan Ni's writing credits are insane. He's got over 200, and a lot of them are actually some of my favorite Shaw Brothers movies. So 36 Chamber of Shaolin, Dirty Ho, 8 Diagram Pole Fighter, The Five Venoms, The One-Armed Swordsman, and like I mentioned, some of my favorites, Human Lanterns, which is still my favorite Shaw Brothers horror movie. I don't think that's ever going to get dethroned. That's the Texas Chainsaw Girl in me. But Five Element Ninjas, The Bloody Parrot, and The Web of Death, which was my double feature pick for our Spider Labyrinth episode.
Yeah. Ho Meng Hua, his output in the mid-70s, second to none, really. If you think about it, like, I don't know, box office wise, if you'd say hit after hit, I mean, they were successful enough. But in my opinion, you've got Flying Guillotine, Black Magic, Oily Maniac, Black Magic 2, Mighty Peking Man, and Vengeful Beauty, all made within 3 or 4 years of each other. Kiss of Death is in there too at 73, I believe. And I mean, all of those are fantastic. If you're into genre cinema at all, they're just solid. Flying Guillotine would be the closest one to like a traditional kung fu movie out of the bunch.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know if you've seen Oily Maniac at
yes.
all. Yeah. So you know where you're going with that one. Mighty Peking Man, same deal there. Like, it's just wild, wild stuff. So much fun.
Yeah, agreed. Do you have a favorite in that bunch, Lance?
Well, I mean, honestly, Shaw Brothers horror is kind of new to me. So I didn't really jump in until we started talking about Shawgust. You know, and I'd watched, you know, 8 Diagram Pole Fighter, the 36 Chamber films. I did see Oily Maniac decades ago. But yeah, I did watch The Mighty Peking Man recently when we started dumbing, and I loved it.
Yes.
I did watch my pick, which we'll announce at the end of this episode, which has been my favorite so far. Honestly, I have not seen Human Lanterns yet. God, I know. Jesus. I haven't seen some of the big name ones, so I'm still going through. I was at first a little intimidated, but I'm telling listeners who maybe not familiar at all with any Shaw Brothers horror, dive right in, because I'm starting to settle in. I'm starting to recognize people and, you know, correlate. Like, this guy might be my favorite director at this point after watching about 6 or 7 the last couple of weeks.
Okay.
And I'm going to thank Ian beforehand for expanding my knowledge on the Shaw Brothers and their catalog. So,
yeah.
But yeah, I loved The Mighty Peking Man. And I mean, I could announce it right now. Corpse Mania. I loved it.
Oh, well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you no mentioned you had mentioned Enter the Fat Ninja in your commentary track. And I was like, oh, I haven't seen that. It's been on my watch list. And so I finally sat down and watched it yesterday. And oh, my God, it's so much fun.
That's funny. I would not have necessarily expected that to be like having had an impact on anybody.
Really? I love Sammo Hung, so I was like automatically oh, he thinks he's Bruce Lee, like I'm 100% in.
No, and I mean, I will watch Sammo in anything. My wife and my stepson and I up. We've been going through the 88 films releases of the Jackie Chan stuff and the Eureka releases, the Jackie Chan stuff that's been coming out the last 2 years. And so, of course, Sam crosses over into tons of that. I don't know, the last year or so, I've just really, Jackie's obviously the king, but he wouldn't be Jackie without Sammo. And I've just got so much appreciation for like how a man of that size and stature can move the way he does.
Right. Yeah.
And the talent that he shows and the skill that he's got, like, he's incredible. He is. And he's so underrated. I mean, he had that television series in the States that kind of brought him up a bit, I guess, in terms of like Western recognition. But I mean, you ask the average person on the street if they know who Jackie Chan is, they're going to say yes. If you ask them if they know who Sammo Hung is, they're not. And part of me thinks it should be the other way around. No disrespect to Jackie, because he's amazing.
Right. No, I mean, you can love all of them, but I also wish that Sammo got some more respect, because it is well-deserved, because it is amazing when you see, like, his rotund little body moving the way that it does. It's like, God, it's amazing. All right. So Lance, you usually talk about the score, and I know there's a lot of, Ian, you mentioned in your commentary, there's a lot of sampling going on in this.
Yes, we won't call it theft. We will call it sampling and not theft.
So I thought a few things were interesting. The nightclub dance scene.
That's the Wailing Whale one, or is that the Last Bongo in Belgium one where they're playing?
That's the Last Bongo in Belgium one by the Incredible Bongo Band. Yes.
And then when they're the wife and the other husband are having an affair in the hotel room, there's the Rizzardolani score from Web of the Spider. Is that his remake of Castle of? He remade his own movie. I think it's Castle of Blood that he remade.
Oh, the Antonio
Margheriti. Yeah. Am I right?
You probably are. Let's say you are.
I'm just going to assume I'm right. But then the Wailing Whale song at the very beginning, that's Nicholas Flagello. Am I saying that right?
I think so.
Okay.
I'm going to mangle everybody's name.
No worries. We're going to do the same. It's fine. It's you know, it's going to come with the territory during Chagas. So.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess Young Yu Chin, is that how you would say the actual composer? I mean, he's just whatever wasn't lifted, or I guess whatever is original in this by him is just him bending genres. I mean, obviously he's pulling like all these samples, and Ian, I did listen to your commentary, and when you started throwing out like all these samples, like, you know, Looking Down the Barrel of a Gun, the Beastie Boys from Paul's Boutique, taking that Last Bongo in Belgium, I was like, holy shit, yes, that's it.
It's funny because when I was familiar with the Paul's Boutique album before I was familiar with Black Magic 2. So when I first saw Black Magic 2, however many years ago, I was like, oh my God, they're stealing from the Beastie Boys.
Right.
Some sort of time machine thing going on here. And then I figured out, oh, wait a minute. No, the Beastie Boys are sampling it. Okay. Like, it made sense. I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Didn't really overthink it, you know. But speaking of sampling, the Flagello music, I think the Wu-Tang Clan sampled that as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you mentioned that. I'm not familiar with Wu-Tang music, but I'm going to.
It's an Unpredictable, I think, is the Wu-Tang song.
I was going to defer to you, Lance, on that. So.
I'm an Ice Cube, more type of. Rap, but okay. Wu-Tang, you gotta love Wu-Tang.
I mean, I don't like them.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah.
With
all I definitely the appreciate their appreciation for Kung Fu.
Yeah, with RZA, and it's fun to listen to like him specifically talk about his inspiration that he grabs from all these movies.
But
back to the score. I mean, it is super funky. One thing that I did watch it first, and then I did throw on the commentary a couple days later, but. One thing that I found funny was right away I wrote some notes down as I was watching it, and I noted it has a Monty Norman style, like an early Bond tune, like a tone to it, kind of a funky action tone.
Yeah.
And then Ian, you pointed out later, you know, in your commentary that there's the Bond villain type with Lolai and his cat acting like, you know,
Blofeld. Yeah, absolutely.
and I think the music, the accompanying soundtrack kind of enforced that belief for me, like it. You know, when we'll get to some of the scenes.
I don't think that was an accident.
Right.
I think there's a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of like deliberate plays like that throughout this movie, which, you know, to me just makes me hold it in that much more regard for that reason. Like, it's not just some, you know, goofy Hong Kong horror movie. Like people are actually putting thought into, well, I'm going to steal, sorry, sample this music or, you know, well, they're not stealing, it's theirs, but I mean, I think there's just a lot more that's going into it, like especially with some of like the camera and lighting choices, like being really reflective of other things that are happening at that time in that decade. So we'll get to all of that too. But yeah, I definitely don't think it's an accident.
No, yeah, the music is just on its own is a star of the film. Like I could listen to it.
The cat is the star of the film.
Okay, the cat is.
All right, yay!
You win this battle.
Always. All right. So getting into some of the cast, and I am apologizing to devoted fans of any of these folks if I am mispronouncing any of them. The most recognizable face to me is Lolai. He plays the black magician, Kang Kong, in this. He's got nearly 200 acting credits. I do love his name, Kang Kong.
Yeah, I just can't help but smile every time.
I'm obviously not going to go through all of his 200 acting credits. Just, I want to briefly just, I mean, he's well known in a lot of these other Shaw Brothers horror movies. The most recent ones I've seen from him that aren't in that realm, The Buddhist Palm, and I watched The Stranger and the Gunfighter, which is him and Lee Van Cleef.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you would like it, Lance. I mean, I love Lee Van Cleef in anything. And then you add Lo Lai in there, and I'm like, oh, sold. I'm watching that.
It's not a perfect film, but it's super entertaining.
Exactly, yes. It's on Tubi.
So. Yeah, and I did watch. I watched Lo Lai's. He starred and directed *Clan of the White Lotus* for Gene Splitation last month, which was, or I guess it's a month, 2 months now.
You stole my next note, Lance.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine. No, it's your movie. It's fine. all right, and so after Lo Lai, we've got. I mentioned in the summary, we've got two couples. So the first couple is Ti Lung. He's Dr. Chi Ching Ping. He's got over 100 acting credits. Aside from Shaw Brothers horror and some kung fu movies, he was in A Better Tomorrow, which I think is probably one of the most... If you looked on Letterboxd, that's probably going to be like the number one movie as far as most recognizable or most popular film, I think is how they sort those by most default. Viewed
and, yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
Or, yeah, maybe it's rating.
And then his wife is played by Tani Tien Ni. She's got just under 50 credits. She was in Battle Wizard, another Shaw Brothers horror movie, Hex. And she was in The Trail, which was one of my June exploitation picks.
Yeah, that's right.
From last month, 2 months ago. All right. And then the other couple, Lam Y2. Got just about 26 acting credits, mostly Shaw Brothers films. And his wife is played by Lily Lee. And she's actually the wife who is the first one to go under a spell and get her breast milk taken from her. She was also in Web of Death, Oily Maniac, Eight Diagram, Pole Fighter, and Come Drink With Me, which also has an 88 Films Blu-ray release with a commentary by one of our previous guests, Sam Deegan.
Nice.
Then we also have Wai Wang. He is the younger guy. He's kind of on the outside, but he hires Lo Lai, or the Black Magician, to cast a spell on the dancer at the nightclub that he wants to be with. He's got 50 plus acting credits. And he also directed a movie that has been on my watch list forever. Ian, have you seen The Lewd Lizard?
No.
Damn it. Okay.
The Lube Lizard?
Lewd.
Oh, Lewd Lizard.
Lube would be just as good, but lewd as in crude.
No, I'm not familiar with that one at all.
All right. I got to track that one down because that just sounds like the name just sounds like it's my jam. And then finally, the White Magician is played by Yong Chi Hing. And he's got over 150 acting credits. Obviously, I can't list all of them off. Couple of highlights. Other than Shaw Brothers horror movies, Men from the Gutter and One-Armed Swordsman. Ian, anything you want to add about any of the cast members?
I just want to say that Lo Lai owns the film. The good guys are all, they're fine, but without Lo Lai, you don't have a movie as far as I'm concerned. My wife said when we were watching it earlier today that he has awesome bad guy eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yes.
And I thought about that as we were watching it, and that's something that's accentuated throughout the movie. And he's perfect as the heavy. And his filmography is extensive. We've seen him play good guys as well. But I think he's a better villain than he is a hero.
Yeah, he is. He's kind of a hero, a good guy in part one, Lo Lai, Ti Lung. But, yeah, he does have that great sneer and evil look. Like
he does.
That brow, that just furrowed brow.
Born to play a villain, really. Yeah. And that's not to take away from some of the martial arts films where, like you said, he's the bad guy in Black Magic 1, but he's also the good guy in Black Magic 1, but he's also the good guy in a bunch of kung fu movies. Five Figures of Death being a prime example. But here, far removed from the martial arts that he was known for prior, he's just weird.
Yeah. I do love that about him, though. And it was weird because, I'd seen Lo Lai in kung fu movies before seeing any Shaw Brothers horror movies. And so... even though I knew it was a horror movie before I started watching it for the first time, I was still, for some reason, it was hard for me to separate him. I was like, when's he going to, break out and do some fights,
Right.
but
and there is that fight towards the end on like the cable car sky car kind of thing, but it's right. but it's so clearly not a James martial
Bond
arts
moment, like
yeah, yes, exactly. But it's so not a martial arts film. It's more of like just like kind of a bitch slap session. Like,
yeah, it really is. It's just kind of pushing each other around, yeah, and stuff. Yeah, I do love it. All right, we're going to get into more of our thoughts about this film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
Let's get this out of the way first. Black Magic 1, Black Magic 2. Mm-hmm. Lance, you have... I mean, I'm just going based off your letterbox ratings. I saw you gave this 3, and then you gave Black Magic 1, or the first one, 3.5. Do you right. have... I mean...
So I did watch these, you know, fairly recently, but like I said, you know, earlier, I am just kind of diving in, sure. and I'm finding, like, what I'm watching today, and if I finish a Shaw Brothers horror movie today, I start thinking about the one I watched prior and how much I respect it and enjoyed it that much more. So okay. I did enjoy and give a higher rating on Letterboxd, completely subjective. You know, I might change it, my rating here and there.
Well, actually, yeah, I don't trust your ratings after Junesploitation now anyway. So
yeah, I mean, my ratings are just there for people to ask questions is really what it is. But I did enjoy part one. I felt like, I loved that opening scene. I thought it was much, I mean, both movies have incredibly great opening scenes, but there is this, you know, I'm just going to jump in real quick to part one where there's a magician that's cutting off this slab of flesh and he yeah. decapitates a corpse and starts cooking it and, you know, over fire. And then that's when the credits like kind of start and I'm just like, okay. Yeah. And the pacing, it has a longer runtime than part two, but I felt, mm-hmm. I felt completely more enthralled with the story. I don't know. I felt like all the characters, I think I do agree that that was a note too, that I think Lolis is arguably, I'm going to say it, arguably the better villain of this. Mm-hmm. The other guy is more of a love story, strange love triangle, right. which yeah. I was into. It was very, I was just into all that. The hopping zombies, you know, played a role in part one. They're female in that one. I don't know. I just, with my first watch of each, I enjoyed part one more.
Okay. I could go back and forth between either. But Ian, you said you like part two better?
I do, and maybe there's some bias there because I did, you know, the commentary for it.
So sure.
personal attachment to the film, and I'm not gonna pretend that's not there.
Right.
But number two to me is more over the top. Like it's interesting that you said that you kind of were drawn towards the soap opera angle of the first one. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me, that's what kind of makes it drop down a notch.
Right.
Compared to part two is the soap opera angle didn't pull me in.
Yeah. And cause you're right. Part two is just, it has those elements, but you know, it throws weird factors like at you, like in between all this, there's no really slow.
It does. And there's a fair amount of weirdness in the first one too, but I feel like the soap opera angle is a little more dominant in the first one than it is in the second one. And in the second one, it's there. It's a necessary plot of the story. There's the whole lusting after my best friend's wife angle and whatnot. Pacing, I think, is better in the second one. And I think it's just a little more over the top and a little bit weirder. And maybe that's what I want. It's like a stronger high, I guess, for me.
I think I'm going to agree 100%. Part two is way weirder than part one.
Yeah, it's... I mean, they're both weird and they're both very special movies. I mean, I remember the first time I saw Black Magic and like they get to the construction site and it's just like wizard battle with lasers yep. and whatever the fuck yep. is going. I was like, what the fuck? I love this.
Shields. This is amazing. I love it.
But then you get to this one and it feels, and Ian, you mentioned this in your commentary as well. When it gets to the last 30 minutes of this film, like the last 30 minutes of Black Magic 2, I already like this movie, but then it just kicks it up a notch in that last 30 minutes because then it starts to feel like a Italian horror movie, but also like a Hammer movie because like everything's on fire at the end. Mm-hmm. And then it's like villain's dead, end credits, everything's on fire. And it's like, it's like a fucking Hammer movie.
It really is. Parts of it feel like Plague of the Zombies to me, maybe because of the zombies.
Yeah.
That could be part of it. But they're also like, you know, the zombies kind of wandering around in their like monk-esque cloaks or robes, whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
Kind of reminds me of the Spanish Blind Dead films as well.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's a direct influence there or not. It could just be me connecting all this crap I've watched over the years in my head, but I see it.
I definitely see the Blind Dead connection too. And I think especially because, you know, the Blind Dead, like, yes, technically, something I didn't mention when we were going through like film details is that this was released in the U.S. as Revenge of the Zombies.
Yes.
And you can see why when you watch the movie. But at one point, the zombies in this are hopping. And generally, mm-hmm. that's a trait reserved for vampires in right. Hong Kong movies. And so
right.
there's this sort of ambiguity about what are these creatures, which also I think you kind of get from the Blind Dead, which are, they're not necessarily, they're this whole other new type of creature. Like they're Knights of the Templar and they're technically zombies, but not really. I mean, you could argue a few ways around that, but I like that part about it too, where it's like this sort of, I think they're zombies, but I don't really know, but it's fine. And that's where like the sort of Italian or Spanish or Euro horror influence comes in too, is like, I don't know what this villain is and I don't care. I just like it.
Right. He's just a bad dude and that's all that matters.
One thing that you had talked about in your commentary. So the spells themselves, and I'm going to talk briefly about the spells and then I have a question, Ian. So
sure.
there's a few different ways that Loli or the Black Magician creates spells. And one of them is he has to shave and burn pubic hairs off of his victim, and then he puts it in potion and makes her drink it, and then that gives her
ripe breast milk.
That gives her breast milk so that he can drink that and stay young. The spikes in the head are what actually wake up the zombies, and if you pull them out, and I think you commented too, Ian, that it sounds like a cork coming out of a wine bottle, which is exactly.
I love the sound design.
Sound design is great, and I think that sound effect makes those scenes so much more impactful than they would have been if it had just been like a simple plunk kind of noise.
Right. Yeah.
It's exactly. So satisfying like, to listen to.
You can, like, when he pulls it out, you hear him wrestling with it, and it's kind of cringy in a good way.
So, the whole spells thing, you mentioned a couple things specifically about the belief in black magic and these spells. And also, you referenced a article from 2012 in the South China Post about fetuses bringing good luck and grilled baby chins for love potion.
Yeah.
That's
weird, right?
Yeah. Like, can you, I mean, you, not for verbatim, but briefly, can you tell listeners what that was about?
If I'm remembering correctly, the article, which was in a legitimate Chinese newspaper, was that a man in China had been arrested for practicing black magic, and that he had been using fetuses in his practices. And I don't know what more to say. He was using fetuses for black magic. And this was like less than 10 years ago. It was 2012. And so, I mean, the article named the guy. They caught him in Bangkok.
And didn't he have like storage of like a bunch
of... Oh yeah. No, he had fetus storage going on and all sorts of stuff. Like it was... The article didn't go into like insane amounts of details where I kind of wish that it had. There were this wasn't the only case of this happening. Like the article also mentioned that like there was a case where like 2,000 fetuses were found in Thailand and authorities believed that like they were going to be sold and
like
for the purposes of possibly using them in like black magic rituals and stuff. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Like it's wild to me that like in the modern day and age that like this would still happen. I mean, I can't say firsthand, obviously I wasn't there. I'm going off of a news article from a reputable site.
I think you mentioned too, like it said preserved fetuses were said to bring good luck. So mm-hmm. people would have them like presented and bottled in their buildings or in their houses.
Yeah, and there was also the oil from a grilled baby could be used as a love potion. I remember that being in the article as well.
That's amazing.
That does work.
Yeah,
that,
right.
You tried it? Yeah, I know that works.
Lance, I expected a better housewarming gift from you than than the plant. You did not get me a fetus in a jar. How dare you? All right. Well, yeah, I have to bring that up because, like, you know, listeners know.
No, I mean, when researching the film, like, that was in a lot of ways way more interesting to me than, like, oh, this guy appeared in this movie and this guy appeared in this movie. You know, that's the easy part. The interesting part for me was, like, trying to figure out, like, okay, how does what we see in the movie, like, what we see Lolai do in the movie, is this based on anything or is this just, like, pulled out of the writer and director's head because it's, you know, weird and creepy and gross?
Right.
They're going for the gross side, or are they basing this on, like, any sort of precedent? And it looks like they were basing it on a precedent.
Yeah, it sounded like it too. Like, I think you also mentioned, you know, when Lolai is bringing the zombies back to life and he cuts his tongue and spits the blood on him, that, you know, that's tied to, like, a Taoist belief in, you know, blood from the tongue and things like that. So,
right.
Again, it adds that much more credulity to it that they're taking the time to think, well, we're not just going to make up all this stuff. We're actually basing it on what people believe. And the fact that people still believe these things, like, as soon, like, as early as, like, 10 years ago.
Right. People believe all sorts of things.
That's true.
But, you know, and
why am I saying this in 2021?
Yeah. You kind of shot yourself in the foot there.
But now I'm interested in part one. There's that, you know, the rice that the black magician makes, the sweet vagina rice.
There you go.
That sweet vagina rice. Is that real? We gotta do some research here for this now. I think in part one too is, cause I did watch these, you know, pretty close together. Mm-hmm. They kind of molding, melding together here for me, but there is a scene where they dig up somebody. I think it's in part one, but they do hold a flame up to the chin of the corpse. And the oil starts coming out in the blood. They keep that too.
That's part one. They do dig up the body in part two as well.
Right.
But they just open it and it's all, like, maggot infested.
Yeah, right. It's full of worms and stuff. Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, that whole scene is very, like, Scooby-Doo gang. Like, hey, let's go dig up the body and find out and solve this case, guys. Let's do it.
And they're really, like, not even fazed by it either. They slice them open and it's full of worms and maggots and stuff. And they're just like, eh, okay.
Yeah.
We're good.
It has to be black magic. Well, perhaps it's just the soil.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're doctors.
Right.
They're scientists.
They do have a scientific view on things.
Yeah, true.
There is a little bit of, like, you just, like, okay, they want to stretch it out a little bit longer, so they can't, like, fully be on board with the black magic just yet. So
right. It's fun seeking out something you can't explain. So.
And then what about the crazy deformed baby scene?
Yes.
Yeah. I love it.
Great practical effects. It's a quick shot of it, but it is, like, kind of pulsating.
It's breathing.
It gave me Cronenberg vibes. Like,
it's totally Cronenberg vibe. Yeah, I thought of the ending of The Brood when I just recently rewatched it, and I was like, there's something moving under there, and that's not cool.
Yeah, my note is monster fetus in all caps. And
I loved it when the doctor actually, you know, performing the C-section, the cesarean section, he kind of pulls it out and very casually, you know, like he delivers this, he does this every other day. He's like a monster.
Yeah.
Just very nonchalant. Got to get back to work.
Another one. When's lunch?
Here we go.
I think, like, so since we're on the subject of the gore, I think, so worms come up a lot in these movies, like worms under the skin specifically, or like having to cut someone and, like, drain worms out of somebody. I do like when they first get to the hospital, the pulsating sores on people, that woman that's on her shoulder, the white magician gouging out. I mean, you don't really see him do it. He does it, like, with his back turned, but he gouges out his own eyes and then hands them to T-Lung. Eat them.
He's got, I mean
if you got to defeat black magic and you got to do it, I guess you got to do it.
It's the whole desperate times desperate measures cliche, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or eat them in the name of science.
And then whenever the zombies are killed or they have the spike taken out of them, when it's not by the black magician, their face melts in, like, the time lapse effect.
Love those.
Those are my favorite.
The spike in the head shows up in Bewitched as well. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that one.
Yes, that was one I did watch.
Yeah. I think we've both seen that. Yeah.
Yeah, that one has more putting spikes in heads versus pulling them out.
Like, right.
Black magic.
Yeah. I like the pulling out better though, because with the sound effect, it's so much fun.
So satisfying.
It is. Yeah, it's better when you're pulling it out than putting it in. But I think in Bewitched, it's a dad saving his daughter by putting the spike in her head.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's noble at least.
Yeah, absolutely.
We haven't talked about, you know, speaking of gore, we haven't talked about the opening scene with.
That's right.
The white magician. You know, first there's like a bunch of girls just kind of getting naked, swimming in a. You know, swimming in a lake or a river.
Yeah, the nudity happens fast.
Yeah.
Right away.
Right away. It's like, you know what you're watching, right?
Yep. And then, you know, follow that up with some violence and a huge alligator coming out and eating or killing one of the women, swimming women. And then the white magician, this old man, you know, with the beard, he has the strength and the core to pull this.
Of course.
800-pound alligator onto the pier while he's fishing out there and cut it open and using an animal. That's what, I guess that's what the Shaw brothers do that. There's a lot of chicken hanging.
I know.
Animal violence isn't crazy uncommon.
Yeah.
Right. In some of their films. It's interesting though, in the opening scene, because like in some shots it's clearly, I mean, obviously a real alligator is not eating that actress.
Right.
And it doesn't take a genius to look at that and go, hey, that part's fake. But yeah, there are other parts where it's like it's edited in and edited out and edited in and edited out. And it's like, okay, yeah. When he cuts that thing open, it looks like a real one. I mean.
It does, but then he pulls out like flip-flops and full like flip-flops.
Yeah.
And then her bracelet. And he's like, yep, this is her.
That's it.
She got eaten 15 minutes ago, but all that's left is her bracelet. I guess they digest quickly. But it's a great scene. I mean, it sets the stage I don't want to say wonderfully. That makes it sound like a happy family film, but
no, I mean, it does.
It sets the stage very well for the craziness that comes in the rest of the film.
Sort of like exotic location there. Like it's completely separate from the rest of the movie, which takes place in the city.
Right.
Yeah. And then you're left wondering like, what did that opening scene have to do with anything? And then as you get further in the movie, you're like, okay, that guy's going to have to come in at some point to help out. He's going to have to come from afar or something.
His connection though, is suspect.
Right.
But what's important is that he shows up. That's what matters.
Exactly. Out of nowhere. That's fine. Yeah. You know, as long as he does. But I love the fake alligator though. Like
fake alligators are a thing for me.
I would pair this with the last shark and just like let that shark just fucking ram its head into the fucking underground tunnel and then let this alligator just sideways chomp on a leg. I mean, I love it. Well, I love the fake stuff.
We guessed it. We did a guest spot on what was for the Dark Age.
Shock and Awe.
Yeah. And I think the Dark Age has one of the best fake alligators.
Best crocodile. Looking ones. I like this one though. Yeah, I like its bright green eyes.
Yeah, they were lighting up.
He was excited. He was about to have a meal, so his eyes lit up. That's what they were going for with that, I think.
But yeah, that opening shot, and then you immediately cut to the big city. So we get that whole mixing, you know, the past with the present, you know, the modern, which, you know, was discussed a lot on the commentary by you, Ian. But, you know, modern man versus the old ways and the ancient beliefs of black magic.
Which is common throughout a lot of the Shaw Brothers horror stuff that deals with like supernatural and magic and witchcraft and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, this one is more, so it's kind of the black magic versus the scientific. In part one, it's more black magic versus like, it's way more religious aspect. But I love how they, you know, if they can't explain anything scientifically in this one, there's a lot of, you know, quick assumptions like, oh, it must be black magic. You know, these people must be under a bad spell, which it's, you know, it's the obvious eternal, the battle of good versus evil. But when you're a scientist, you know, you can't really, you have to see these facts and stuff. So that's why I think it's hilarious that T. Lung, who basically sends off his best friend and his girlfriend or his partner to go get cursed to prove that this spell exists, like that black magic is real. And that's just a hilarious setup.
Yeah. The fact that also he's looking through a book and Lo Lai is in the fucking book.
Yes.
Like, doing stuff.
Well, it is photographed in the book in his black magician outfit.
Yeah.
I also love the fact that like when Lo Lai is decked out in all his garb with the hood and the cloak and everything, that he's wearing a shirt and tie underneath it.
Yeah. He's fancy.
It's a businessman. He's like the candy tangerine man. You know.
He's a businessman. He's got it nailed down. He even says at one point, that, oh, $5,000 for my services isn't expensive because for every spell I cast, I lose 5 years of my life. So give me $5,000. And I think he even specifies American dollars.
Yeah, he does. That was hilarious. So how old is he? Because maybe that book is an old publication because he drinks the breast milk to look 30.
Yeah.
He said, I think he says he's 80 in the film.
Oh, okay. That's not that old.
Yeah.
That's
right. But still, I mean, the fact that like he, I love his whole business model too. Like he's, he's got this, these girls or like the one girl that the dancer and he get like all these guys want to be with her. So he gets them to pay him money to cast a love spell, which temporarily will work, but he gets the money. He's got this whole great, and he's got like, he's like, yeah, I got tens, you know, there's tons of other guys who want her too. And I'm casting spells for all of them too. So he's kind of like, he's making his money. Like,
I mean,
respect.
Black magic seems to be like a good source of income because I feel like in all the Shaw movies, usually it has to do with revenge or, you know, loss of love or trying to gain love. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not really, it's evil, but it's just the greed of people coming and seeking out these magicians, you know?
It's greed and like you said, love too. Like a lot of people are like, well, Black Magic 2, I'm in love with my best friend's wife.
That should have been the name of the movie, Black Magic 2, I'm in love with my best friend's wife.
It's better than Revenge of the Zombies.
Yeah,
that's true.
I mean, here's the thing is I don't blame the magicians because they wouldn't be in business unless people came to them asking for spells and paying them money. Like
they're adapting to the times.
Yeah, exactly. They're not the bad guy. If I had black magic skills, you better believe I would fucking quit my job and like put a sign on the door like love spells, $5,000.
Yeah. Pew potion, $5,000.
What else is he going to do? He's not going to learn to code. I mean,
right. Fuck, I don't want to learn to code.
Man, I want to see him develop a computer game. That will be like a black magic.
The black magic one with like the laser hands and stuff. I think we kind of talked about already like some similarities to, especially at the end, Italian and Hammer films. I think one of the things that you also brought up in your commentary too, specifically related to Hammer movies and Dracula movies, is having the black magician and then the bride sort of being under a spell and being summoned to him. And he does that with multiple women in this film.
Yes.
I think like some of the lighting and obviously the gore. I know Fulci is later than this movie, but I can't not think of Fulci whenever I see Maggots now because his name is just synonymous with that.
That's fair.
Now, even though this was first, I guess maybe like I don't know if I could really say like draw a line between the gore. Definitely some of like the lighting and like the atmosphere choices that are going on in it, I do feel though.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, because the music right away was standout for me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were some, you know, the foggy streets and stuff, you know, the foggy exterior shots, the blue lightning that happens and lights up rooms and exterior shots did remind me of Hammer. But the music, everything was kind of accentuated by the music and the horror elements and the entire story is moved along by the score in a lot of ways. So I kept kind of with my first watch, I kept thinking of I Walked with a Zombie and also the zombies aspect.
Yeah.
Just because of the music, the driving of the music and kind of the hauntingness when it did have the actual like synth score, like when there was a literal synth score or they might be some strings in the background or something. Sure. But yeah, there seems to be a lot of, I mean, Black Magic obviously inspired, well, I guess was inspired by, you know, some older movies, but inspired most of what came out of it, most to come later. Hammer films, Fulci, like you said.
I think, too, is so the Black Magician's lair down below, like all the little set dressing things. Like,
oh, it's amazing. You've got like a wall with shelving full of like little wax voodoo dolls and coffins. And then you've got all these corpses on stone beds. And then he's got like his little chemistry set that he's mixing breast milk and pubic hair and blood.
Yeah, skulls and like
one of the most ridiculous looking skulls you'll ever see. It's like very prominently displayed on a little spike on his desk. He's got it going on. It's a perfect spot to do whatever it is that he's doing.
Yeah, to do all of his business. So
yeah,
I love when he gets his He does it in both, Low Lie. So in King Kong, you know, when you have a name like King Kong, you're going to have an awesome lair like that. Like,
I mean, I should think so. Yeah.
You have to. But when he gives the flowers to get the blood, you know, from the thorns.
Oh, yeah. When he just shows up at their house.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let him in. Yeah.
This guy's a pro because in part one, he's, you know, flipped aside. He's kind of a good guy in there. But he needs hair in part one from a woman in order to give to the black musician to make her fall in love. So he claims, ah, there's a spider in your hair.
Yeah.
So this guy's a pro at getting what he needs in order for black magic to move forward.
Yeah.
Between part one and two, that's a better role for Low Lie, 100%. Because we do get to also see him battle it out on a cable car.
Yeah. I love that scene so much. It's
so cool. And okay, you watch it, and yes, obviously it's a hokey dated optical effect, right?
Sure. I mean,
there's no denying that. But if you look at the way they lined it up,
yeah,
it's really damn close. I mean, they put a lot of care and attention into that. I don't know if they knew how ridiculous it might wind up looking, but yeah. I mean, it's done well. The angles are perfect. If they'd have matched the film stock.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fall from when Low Lie falls from the cable car.
Yeah.
Down to the water. Yeah.
That seemed like a, you know, that was like a 10-foot drop.
Oh, if that. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, maybe the camera was down. But I just love that because it was so odd and it came completely out of left field. There wasn't a whole lot of fighting or any type of physical, you know, kung fu or anything or martial arts or any type of exhibit of these characters having any skills of brawling.
There's nothing pre-established at all in that regard. Like nobody is like shown training in the backyard or,
right,
you know, working in a punching bag in the basement or anything like that. Like he's just like, all of a sudden there's a cable car. Let's do it.
Yeah. And that was one of my favorite scenes. Cause I was just beaming like, oh my God, where are we going now? Cause this, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah.
They're throwing everything at me and I love it.
And I think too, coming off of, cause I think you watched them out of, you watched two first and then one, right?
Right.
Okay. So when I watched one, and I think coming into rewatching two, cause it had been a while, I didn't actually remember how it ended. And so I was like, is there a wizard battle at the end? And then I was like, and then our white magician dies. And I was like, oh wait, no. And then it's like cable car. And I was like, I remember this movie now. And that's why I love it.
Yeah, it's great.
Anything else in your notes, Lance, that you want to?
No, I mean, I'm good.
All right.
I'm good with mine.
Ian, anything we haven't touched on yet in this movie that you want to talk about?
Not off the top of my head. I'll probably interrupt you in a few minutes when something pops into my feeble brain.
No worries.
We
do that all the time. All right. So let's get to our double feature picks then. Ian, do you want to go first or do you want us to go first? Up to you.
Oh, I don't really care. I can go first.
Okay, go for it.
So I had three ideas in my head. My first idea was obviously black magic, but I thought that's too obvious. And then I thought maybe Bamboo House of Dolls because of the Low Lie connection. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not. Shaw Brothers Women in Prison.
Yeah. I haven't seen it yet. It's on my watch list, but yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's Shaw Brothers doing a women in prison film, and it hits all those notes.
Perfect.
But ultimately, I decided on Seeding of a Ghost.
Nice.
Very nice.
I haven't seen it. I own that one. I love that movie.
Yeah, and really, it's the last 15 minutes of Seeding of a Ghost that makes me think it's the perfect double feature, because I think the last 15 minutes of Seeding of a Ghost tops Black Magic 2 in terms of like crazy sorcerer nonsense and corpse magic and all that crazy stuff. I don't want to go too far into spoiler territory, but I think it outdoes Black Magic 2.
I would agree with that. I think it does too. I'll loan it to you before you leave.
Oh, great.
So I would watch Black Magic 2 first because obviously I love that movie, but I would watch Seeding of a Ghost after it because you want to save the best for last.
That ending, yeah.
That ending is nuts.
Let people walk out and just be like, ah!
Yep. Yep.
Nice. I can't wait. I want to see this right now.
Well, just wait 5 minutes. All right, Lance, what's your double feature pick?
Okay, so I didn't go with a Shaw pick. Same thing like you, Ian. I thought, okay, you can get both Black Magics in one night.
Sure, and you would do very well with both of them.
Yeah. Exactly,
Not a wrong answer.
Right, I think everything we're throwing out would be great. Bewitched was another one, because when I watched that, there's a lot of similarities there. But I went with the film that I had added on our list when we first started making lists of movies. It had under 600 views, but it has since been added to Shudder, so it's taking off. It's close to 1,000. But my double feature pick is Queen of Black Magic from 1981.
Oh, yay. That's over 1,000 now?
Nine something.
Emergency episode. Right. I'm just kidding.
But directed by Lilik Sugio, if I'm saying that right. So it starts off a woman's marrying a man, but she starts having these visions that are kind of terrifying her. She sees monsters and snakes, kind of some similarities there in Black Magic 2. But she's seeing these monsters in place of her groom and her family and like the wedding decorations that are around. And the groom blames his bride's evil visions on a woman in the village named Murni, played brilliantly by the Indonesian actress Susanna, mm-hmm. who she is so great in this. But he had slept with her previously and accuses her of using black magic. So he gets this gang of friends together. They find Murni and they throw her off a cliff, intending to kill her. But this old man saves her, teaches her the ways of black magic, which she does and becomes the Queen of Black Magic.
Yeah.
She returns to the village, gets revenge on all those who basically tried to kill her, you know, using her new black magic skills, while also stealing a baby along the way. But obviously, yeah, it has a lot of similarities to Black Magic too, you know, including casting spells on people as revenge. There's also some spells throughout the movie, you know, with gaining love. I think it was great seeing a woman as a black magician, because the villagers, specifically the men, they're extremely frightened of a woman practicing black magic. So they quickly try to destroy her, where the opposite in Black Magic 2, they're all, oh, this dude's a black magic. I'm gonna flock to him and get my wishes granted.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of similarities, has some great focus chanting by the black magicians, voodoo doll statues with big dongs hanging off of them. Worms and maggots make an appearance. Also has some human breastfeeding, but it's just a woman and a baby. But yeah, a lot of great shots. Queen is way gorier. This will be a spoiler, but I mean, it you're going to love it. I mean, a dude rips his own head off. I mean, come on.
It's pretty great.
I've seen it, and yeah, that's a solid choice. If you like that type of stuff at all, if you're not familiar with some of the other kind of crazy horror films that Susanna was into or right. starring in, then you should check out Snake Queen.
Yes.
And there's a sequel. Hungry Snake Woman is the sequel to it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how easy they are to come across in legitimate form.
Snake Queen, actually, I just watched that on YouTube because that was going to be my double feature pick.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not now because you just did an Indonesian film, so I want to keep it like different. So okay. I'm going to go with my backup one now.
Well, yeah, Snake Queen sounds, I mean, that one would be just...
There's child or toddler dismemberment in the Snake Queen.
Oh, Snake Queen is fantastic.
Yeah.
Queen of Black Magic came out on DVD through Mondo Macabro in like...
Yeah, 2008 or something.
Oh, that sounds right.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's if the DVD out there, I think it's pretty tough to find at this point.
I'm sure it's long out of print. A lot of their stuff from that period is, unfortunately.
It is on Shudder, though, for anybody that does want to take a look at it. And there was kind of a new 2019 remake called Black Magic.
So that's been on. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I saw it. It premiered at Fantastic Fest.
Is it worthwhile? Because it's been on my radar, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it is worthwhile.
Okay.
It's got a lot of really cool. I mean, it does have some CGI effects, but it's done very well. But it does have some great practical effects, too. A lot of great insect stuff.
Right.
They twist the story up a lot, but there's a lot of family connection like there is in the original. It's good. It's worth checking out for sure.
Okay.
What about you, Erica?
Well, since I can't do the Snake Queen anymore,
you can. There's no rules.
I
mean,
I know there's no rules, but I want to keep it different because you went to Indonesia. But I do recommend the Snake Queen. I'm going to read you my Letterboxd review of it really quickly.
Okay,
it's on YouTube if anyone wants to watch it. Snake Queen 1982. Bow to me, your Snake Queen, as I descend these disco steps from my golden flying horse-drawn carriage. extra half star for toddler dismemberment. So, yeah, my backup pick is going to be a Cast a Deadly Spell double feature. I'm going to go with Baba Yaga from 1973, directed by Corrado Farina. Stars Carol Baker as a witch, and she casts a spell on a fashion photographer, played by Isabel... Oh, fuck, what's her last name? De Fuentes, I think?
De Fuentes is correct, yeah.
Okay, thank you. George Eastman plays her boyfriend. Ooh. Love George Eastman. And so he's trying to get her out from under the spell of Baba Yaga, Carol Baker's character. So kind of like Black Magic 2, which has sort of multiple genres, clear influences happening, like exploitation and gothic happening. Baba Yaga has a lot of elements as play as well. It's got eroticism. It's got a gothic element to it too, a supernatural element. And really just at like sort of the basic level, it's, you know, about casting spells and keeping other people under your thumb kind of thing. I would do Baba Yaga first, I think, and then end with Black Magic too.
Cool.
Just to end on like the more bonkers one. I might scare a few people off because, you know, Baba Yaga is not going to be for everybody, but...
Yeah, I mean, like it. I've seen it a few times.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Cool. So I like it.
It's a cool, super stylish, super just cool in the way that like the Italian films from that era were. And obviously, yeah Carol Baker is majestic in it. And George Eastman is George Eastman, and you can't help but love him.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Isabel Dufanes is beautiful in it. And it's just, you could argue it's style over substance. It's based on, I've never read the comic book that it's based on. I'm familiar with Guido Cripax, the guy who made the comic that it's based on, but yeah. I haven't read this particular work. I don't know if either of you have or not.
I was actually going to ask you, because that was kind of why it was my backup pick. I was like, oh, that one's also based on a comic. I wonder if Ian's read it, because that's, but okay. I have not.
Yeah, so. No, I have not. I would like to. I don't honestly know if there's an easily accessible English language version of it.
Oh, okay.
A lot of his stuff has been translated into English and released domestically, but I don't know if that one has or not. And I'm not going to lie and say I've done a ton of research in it because I haven't. But I feel like if it was out there and easily accessible, I would know. But I can't know everything.
Find out. Lance, did you say what order you wanted yours to go in, Lance?
No, I would probably end... I'd end it with Black Magic, too. I'd start with Queen of the Black Magic.
Okay.
And end it with Black Magic too.
All right, so we're continuing Shoggist. Next episode, Lance.
Yeah, Shoggist continues with my pick, and I am going with Corpse Mania from 1981. Let's hear about it. After a stinky body is discovered in a house, Chief Police Inspector Chang notices similarities involving another case in a neighboring village, and the similarities being how the women are murdered and that the corpse are sexually defiled. We have necrophilia people, one of Erica's favorite subjects. And while investigating, the inspector comes across an upscale brothel, which connects all the victims. He also learns that the main suspect, well-known necrophiliac, Lin Ping, or Mr. Li, was coincidentally released from the asylum he was committed after having been accused of similar crimes in the past. So determined to put an end to all the violent murders and all the sex with corpses going on, the inspector tries to make sense of the numerous twists in the case before the killer can strike again. So Corpse Mania, directed by, if I say this right, Kwai Chi-Hung, who directed a ton of Shaw Brothers films.
Including Bamboo House of Dolls.
Bamboo House of Dolls, The Boxer's Omen, Hex, and also Bewitched, which we had talked about.
And Killer Snakes, which if I remember correctly, is coming. Killer Snakes is coming out on Blu-ray from Unearthed Films.
Yeah.
Sooner rather than later.
Nice.
If I am remembering that correctly, which is a good thing because I don't think it's ever had a legit uncut release in the States before.
Sweet. Looking forward to that.
Heck yeah. So
Corpse Mania is a killer film. That's a fantastic choice. I look forward to listening to that.
Oh, thanks. So for the listeners out there, it's you can't find it like a lot of Shaw horror films. You can't really find it streaming anywhere, but there is a DVD out there that was released in 2008 by Image Entertainment, and you could pretty much find it for under $10. But it currently has 471 views on Letterboxd. I think it's totally worth buying, owning, and rewatching. It's a quick 82-minute watch. We'll discuss all the reasons why it's worth watching on the next episode.
Yay, Shoggist continues. All right, if you are not already, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and Slasher, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd, Twitter, and Instagram at Hex Massacre. Lance?
I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at LShibe.
Ian, where can folks follow you, find your website, all the good things? I mean, we'll put a link in show notes too, but just to remind folks.
Yeah, the website is rockshockpop.com. It's spelled exactly like it sounds. And I'm on Twitter at rockshockpop. And I am on Instagram at IanJane75. My Instagram is mostly pictures of comic books and beer. Not so much movie stuff, but movies pop up there too.
Nice.
Old records, weird random crap. Yeah, again, rockshockpop.com. We update daily. There's a message board there. Sign up. Most of us aren't jerks.
Awesome. Ian, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this, our first movie for Shoggoth, and sharing your knowledge and your commentary. I really enjoyed it. I know you said you weren't sure how you felt about it, but I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was really helpful.
I sincerely appreciate you saying that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, same, Ian. And thanks for, you know, kind of laying down the Shaw Brothers knowledge on for me and for a lot of listeners who might be jumping in.
There's a lot more people out there who know a lot more than I do, but I had fun, and I appreciate you guys inviting me on.
Awesome. Well, thanks to Ian once again, and thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you back next episode for Corpse Mania as Shaggoth continues. Night, y'all.
Bye.
Bye.